Okay. So I'd like to thank Eldia, who is not here right now, for inviting me for this workshop. So I'll talk about this magnetic and electronic inhomogeneities that are observed in films. So this is the list of my collaborators. This Gabriel Apley at UCL, who was involved in the projects, both palladium cobalt and the manganite LSMO, which I'll be talking about. The rest of the people here were involved in the X-ray scattering of the manganites. And then the people here are the people who provided the manganite films. Now, so this is the outline of my talk. I'll talk about magnetic force microscopy as a probe to study disorder magnets. And the first system that I'll talk about will be palladium cobalt, which is not, it's not a strongly correlated electron system. It's just a very simple intermetallic ferromagnet. And I'll show you how we use the MFM to solve some interesting puzzle, and then how that technique was applied later to manganese, which is a strongly correlated electron system. And then this system, I'll just show very, very briefly what has been discovered lately by my collaborator, Neil Mather, and we're working on it to try to understand the origin of the charge order inhomogeneity in this film. Now, so as everybody knows, when you have a phase transition, so this is a magnetic order parameter as a function of temperature, you can obtain these magnetization curves at different fields, and the ideal thing is to measure the order parameter zero field because there's this smearing of the transition due to the QE tail. So it's ideally to try to probe things at zero magnetic field. And the other thing that you observe is when you run hysteresis loops, the hysteresis is only observed at temperatures below TC. So you see that at T equals TC, there's no hysteresis. So the magnetization at zero field is zero. So this hysteresis loops arise due to the formation of magnetic domains, and you get rid of the magnetic domain walls at high magnetic fields, and that's how you saturate the magnetization. And the reason why you have lower magnetic moment at zero fields is not because the ordering is less. It's basically you're chopping up your sample into domains, and so the net moment is reduced. So there's this need to, preference to extract the order parameter at H equals zero. And so we thought that the magnetic force microscope would be a good probe for that because you don't need to apply an external magnetic field to look at the moments. You can observe them at zero magnetic field. Now, the system that we chose was palladium cobalt. The reason is because it has an interesting phase diagram where if you start mixing up palladium to cobalt, you can reduce the QE temperature. So since it's very hard to operate scanning for microscope at these elevated temperatures to study magnetic phase transitions at such high temperatures using a scanning probe, then we wanted to lower the ferromagnetic transition temperature by adding palladium. And this is a very interesting system because even at very, very small percentage of cobalt, you still have a ferromagnetic transition. So you see that you can go up to 90, above 90% of palladium and still have a ferromagnetic order. Well, that's an interesting thing. I'll show you the effect of it, what we see. So these are just magnetization curves for palladium cobalt. So we chose this compound, 0.89 palladium diluted cobalt. And these are the different magnetization curves that you obtain at different fields. So you see that at 500 Gauss, this is the curve was, you see more and more smearing as you apply a higher magnetic field. So this is a 5 Tesla thing, and at this point it's very, very hard to know what's the transition temperature. So that's why when you try to do this determination of the order parameter, you try to apply the smallest magnetic field that will give you a sensible signal. And this is a separate curve that was obtained by running hysteresis loops and then looking at the remnant magnetization at zero field. And you see that the temperature dependence is different from the temperature dependence at the finite field. So we'll get back into that. So here, I'm showing the case of N versus T at 100 Gauss. And we apply the field both in plane and out of plane. And these are the magnetization curves. And based on this, we expected the Curie temperature about 370 Kelvin. On the other hand, when we ran the hysteresis loops, now in this case, the magnetic field was applied out of the plane. There is hysteresis at room temperature where it disappears at 360 Kelvin. So 10 Kelvin below the expected transition temperature based on this measurement. So this is the puzzle. Which macroscopic quantity really reflects the order parameter? Are we supposed to look at that hysteresis loops and see where the remnant magnetization disappears, so where there's no hysteresis, or are we supposed to look at that N versus T at a finite field? So which one does it tell you the transition temperature? So this is in contrast to what I showed you first when I showed you that the hysteresis loops are supposed to disappear at the transition temperature. Now, the magnetization that we measure at a finite field is basically the difference between the up-domain volume and the down-domain volume times the intra-domain magnetization. So the thing that we're really interested in, when we think about the order parameter is the intra-domain magnetization. We don't want this extra thing to couple in. And when we're measuring things at a finite field, the fact is that there's the, difference between the up-domain volume and the down-domain volume. That's how we get some net magnetization to measure. So you are disturbing the magnetic domain pattern. You are applying a magnetic field to actually overcome this, take this thing out of zero.
Is there a suitable nucleus to do
I don't know. I'm not a nuclear NMR person. If probably, you could use other probes, but these very standard probes that people use, like squid magnetometer, always is based on upsetting the equilibrium of the two. So to get a net moment. And so what I'm trying to show is that those very simple probes are not working.
This bit is really tiny, like little sub-micron ones like Catherine Miller is using. So what is the size?
So in that case, then that's a local probe. Again, so we're getting back to the local probe. So that's why we are thinking of, that's why we thought of using magnetic force microscopy to try to understand.
Right. Isn't that because you made a statement that squids will not work? I mean, if it's really tiny, then it's will
work. Well, if you make it smaller than the domain size, and so if you can resolve the domains, then yes. And what I'm talking about is the macroscopic squids, the standard squids. So this is the magnetic domain of the sample at room temperature. So this is a highly ramified magnetic domain pattern. The sample is polycrystalline, so it has lots of small grains, but there's no alignment of the magnetic domain pattern with the grains at this temperature. And the wall spacing is about 300 nanometers. I'm not sure if the squid has that resolution of 0.3 microns. I have to check. So that's scanning screen. So you know, you're talking about small length scales, and then from this domain pattern, you can tell that there's a polarization perpendicular to the plane, which is also verified by the hysteresis loops. This is the magnetic domain pattern of the sample. It was mapped using MFM, magnetic force microscopy. If we could do optics, I think you have to worry about the spatial resolution.
MFM is sensitive to the main walls, right? Because that's where magnetization sort of pops out from the...
Right. But in this case, when you have them perpendicular, when you have the magnetization perpendicular, then it's more sensitive to the domains than the domain walls, because it's then where you have the magnetization pointing out and pointing down.
So how can you say by looking at this picture that the magnetization is like this as opposed to like that?
This is very typical of the way that, you know, magnetization perpendicular to the plane looks like. The other thing is that, you know, there's no like direct way of telling. But if you had, for example, an in-plane magnetization and then you saw domain walls, you would certainly see a different domain pattern than this. So you have to make a judgment based on looking at the whole picture. You cannot say, well, if I locally look at this, oh, I know that this is the you know, domain, not the domain wall. But by looking at the whole picture, you say that you would not get such a field pattern if it was an in-plane magnetization.
Just kind of a topological argument, you mean? I mean, so white is high signal, right? Is that the...
Yes, this is basically, one is a positive signal, this is a negative signal. If it's pointing up or pointing down. The domains are pointing up or pointing down.
Because whites seem to be more narrow than the darks, right? So in principle, you could say this white side are the main ones.
I think that's optical illusion.
I think this is illusion. Actually, this is visual illusion. So if you did, if you actually did, you know, if you look at the signal numerically, and then if you took the average, you would get an average of zero. Yes, there is anisotropy in this thing, and this system, palladium cobalt, is famous for perpendicular magnetic recording, potential candidate for perpendicular magnetic recording. I think it was the first system, so the palladium or platinum series made in multi-layers with, let's say, cobalt or iron type of transition metals were the first systems that show perpendicular anisotropy in a film. Because the films, due to the geometry, want to have the magnetic easy axis in the plane. Whereas this is the first time, I think it was in the late 1980s. Actually, it was pretty late when that was discovered, this multi-layer platinum cobalt, you know, type of series for palladium cobalt. So to try to, you know, do cross-checks about, you know, whether we can use this microscope to look at how the magnetic order parameter changes as a function of temperature, we did comparisons with cobalt and palladium. So cobalt is non-magnetic, and palladium is non-magnetic. I mean non-ferromagnetic. Okay, it's a paramagnet. Cobalt is has a high transition temperature, and so we did the different scans at room temperature and at elevated temperature and see whether it does show a difference depending on the system. And you see in the case of cobalt, there's almost no reduction in the contrast. In the case of palladium, what you're picking up is actually topography. This is nothing to do with ferromagnetism. And then you see that in the case of palladium cobalt, there's a drastic change in the contrast. So if you plot the contrast as a function of temperature for the different systems, in the case of palladium, it stays flat, you know, because this is basically just... this is background, what you can consider is as a background, just coming from topography. The case of the cobalt, it goes down a bit, and this is not because the cobalt magnetization is going down, it's actually the tip magnetization that is going down. So there's an interaction between the tip and the cobalt. and the tip has a lower Q temperature than the cobalt. So it's that magnetization that is going down. And then this is the palladium cobalt that shows a very sharp decrease. So you see that the method is efficient. There's cobalt, chromium. The other thing that I like to point out, you know, why this is going down is the mechanical properties of the cantilever that is changing. It's getting softer as you warm up. Okay, so that's why you need to take into account the probe as well when looking at the thing. But the important thing is that this change is pretty small, whereas this change is much larger. So we took into account this change in trying to understand the change here. So we incorporated in later in when we did the analysis and understanding this.
Is there any significance in the fact that the patterns have changed from 299 to 350? It's the same sample you're looking at?
It's the same sample, but it's not the same region because there's a drift. But the patterns, which is a good question, gets more ramified as you warm up the temperature. So I don't think I have a view graph that directly compares the same region. I did some analysis that compares exactly the same region, so taking into account the drift, so I was able to move back. So if there's a finite drift as you elevate the temperature, you see that when you elevate it even from 300 to 310 Kelvin, you start creating small domain walls that start chopping, let's say, this longer domain into two pieces and so on. And as you raise the temperature, that happens more and more. And then at very high temperatures near the transition temperature, it becomes much more ramified, which is something that, unfortunately, I didn't bring with me. And there, the grain boundaries do play a role in how the domain patterns are formed. So it doesn't show up here at lower temperatures, but it shows up later at higher temperatures.
The surface is actually quite rough, right? That's what you're saying?
It's not rough. It's just that you have grains.
How big are the grains?
The grains, I remember. Let me see. I have to look at this. So basically, the grains are in this length scale. They're about this size. So probably they're about, this is 2.5 microns. So probably it's like 0.1 micron or smaller. Smaller grains. Several grains. Lots of grains. Yeah.
So the sample scope is the film, or
it's a film. So it's a 900 nanometer film. It's a very thick film.
And why the instrumentation is sticking out then? The instrumentation would want to put it in 20.
Yes, so as I pointed out, that this is the first system where people found perpendicular magnetization. And we think that it has to do with the strain on the film, because when the film peels off and then it's a freestanding form, and if I run the squid magnetometer now, there's no longer perpendicular magnetization. So the same thing, now after having been released from the substrate, shows a different magnetic anisotropy. So I think that is strain related. So this is the image at 300 Kelvin, and as we warm up the sample, you see that the contrast is going down. So this is 340 Kelvin. I kept the color contrast the same, same scale, so that as you warm up the sample, you see that it's getting diminished. And 345, 350, 355, you still see domains, okay, there. At this point, it's actually starting to get harder and harder to see anything. And 360 Kelvin, I think that they're gone. We raised the temperature even higher, and you know definitely that at this temperature, like 365, there's no domain pattern. So it looks like our MFM data traces better the remnant magnetization, that you don't have ferromagnetic order anymore above 360 Kelvin. And this is the 370 Kelvin data. These are more, I amplify the contrast just to look at the images better at the elevated temperatures. And you see that there's still something there, but once you go above 360, at 365, there's clearly no domain. This is all noise. The histories vanish at 360. Yes. Whereas the 100 Gauss magnetization, you know, shows, implies a Curie temperature of 370 Kelvin, 10 Kelvin higher. So that's the puzzle. Now, we did the power spectral density of these images, and you see that the peak amplitude, which represents the domain spacing, remains constant even at you know, as we warm up the sample. So this is the plot of the peak amplitude as a function of temperature. But if you look at if we normalize the peak, you see that as we raise the temperature, there are more and more power spectral density at shorter wavelengths. So the domain starts getting more ramified. And we see that in real space where we see highly ramified pattern. We did the same measurements with a quieter microscope, and then you can really see how the grain boundaries are playing a role in the domain ramification at higher temperatures. And because the power spectral weight from this shorter wavelengths are much smaller than the peak amplitude, whether you use the peak amplitude to try to trace the order parameter or the sum of all this power spectral weights, it's follows a linear curve more or less, because this contribution is much smaller because this is a logarithmic scale. Now, so we can extract the order parameter from the MFM image either by using the RMS of the image or looking at the power spectral density and tracing the peak amplitude. And that's what we did. So here we plotted them. This is an arbitrary unit. So this is the temperature dependence of M versus H, I mean M versus T at a finite magnetic field. This is the remnant magnetization. And this is this red data is from the MFM image. You see that the MFM image traces the RMS, the remnant magnetization, much more closely than this finite field measurement. We did more detailed measurements here, so this is again showing the difference. You know, what happens when you do measurements at high fields is all smeared out. You can't really tell where's the transition. And then here's the comparison of the remnant magnetization with the peak amplitude or the RMS of the MFM images. You see that it traces extremely nicely, and this is, you know, we concentrate the measurements at this, you know, temperature range, you know, which is close to the transition temperature, and it traces very nicely. So we think that the RMS is what really represents the order parameter, not the finite field measurement. So why is there such a discrepancy? We think that it's a compositional disorder. So I showed you the phase diagram of palladium cobalt that has a strong dependency of the transition temperature depending on the composition. So even though you have nominally a composition of, let's say, 0.89 palladium and 0.11 cobalt, locally on an atomic scale, there will be fluctuations. Okay, the composition is not going to be, on an atomic scale, perfect like that. And so there will be local fluctuations of the, you know, exchange coupling constant. And so you can imagine, for example, when T is lower than the transition temperature, then you have a percolated ferromagnet. You can have some holes there, but it still will show ferromagnetism. Whereas if you go above the, you know, percolation, you know, threshold, so if you now have this isolated super paramagnets, it's not going to, and these are very small, okay, you know, so they're super paramagnets. It's not going to show any hysteresis, and we're not going to pick it up in our MFM. They're just way too small, and also they will be constantly fluctuating as a function of time. But if you apply a magnetic field, it's going to have a huge response, and so that's why we'll really smear out the transition. And so it will lead a misleading Curie temperature. So basically we think that this compositional disorder that accounts for the discrepancy of the two measurements. And by using a local probe, we were able to, you know, distinguish between the two pictures. The question?
It's E greater than T series, and if you apply magnetic fields, then in principle you would polarize those superparamagnets.
Yes.
Do you see that? I mean.
Oh, if we apply a magnetic field? The thing is that this region is probably very small, so that it will be hard to see them with the MFM.
Right? So if you're not too far away from TC and above TC, then applying a magnetic field will polarize those guys. I mean, they're fluctuating, all right, but I mean, if you're
right.
Field, then you...
It is possible. I think it's something that we can try experimentally, try to polarize them, and then see whether we can find them, even though the probe itself will not be able to show such a small thing, whether there's a strong signal, and then it will look like an apparent larger Fermi-Yang region. It is possible. But if they're very close to each other, then it will all kind of look homogeneous, and so then we won't see any more domain contrast. Well, imagine that you have them really, really close, all of this. And so then in the end, what you're mapping is a uniform thing. And so you don't see any more contrast. And then...
So the range of the point response function has to be comparable with the separation between those guys. But I mean, it's not too much larger than you're going to see some variation.
Right. Yes.
How big are you imagining these regions are? I mean, are they the size of one of your grains? Or are
they... They should be much smaller because it's due to the compositional disorder. So there should be atomic scale fluctuations of the composition. And so here means that, you know, you have, you know, cobalt more than 11%. Here you have less, more, less, more, less. And so it's an atomic scale where you have those fluctuations.
We don't have our expert who gave a talk on Griffith phases a couple of weeks ago. In principle, my understanding of Kirchhoff was that as the TC is in such a situation where there is if TC is suppressed, so if it is suppressed in near zero, it might become much more observable effects of Griffith's phase of this locally ordered regions than there would be for some finite energy. Is that the people who have also done a correct assessment? Or?
So they were talking about when the TC goes all the way down, in that vicinity, these bubbles acquire a quantum character that may enhance some effects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the question is, can one tune TC to so low that you
You can tune it. Mm-hmm. As you see, the phase diagram shows that you can really drive the TC to zero. But
would you not be able to relate the packages you increase the short wavelength fluctuations at near TC? Is that not related to this?
I thought that has to do more with the domain ramification of this. Could be.
The other thing about the quantum phase transition, of course, this material, can you show the phase diagram?
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's better to escape.
You have the magnetic phase diagram?
Yes, I have it.
This stuff is actually already into the quantum critical region, if you like.
It's
11%,
so it's
square right
here.
Your TC is way suppressed relative to the TC of the pure compound, so you would expect this actually is in the same regime as the ITC materials at room temperature, which also natural quantum fluctuations. So the underlying exchange costs, I mean, the temperatures at which you're operating are a very small fraction of the underlying exchange costs.
Yes.
So,
right,
there is, I think, new energy scale associated exactly with this rare region because it probably has to do with the width of the
distribution?
Yeah, I don't, again, the person to ask to call those solutions.
It has to do with the curvature of the face boundary. So it has to do with how low you are down, and it has to do with how curved it is. But I would, my guess is that not unlike, I mean, also a lot of transition metals, even at room temperature, basically, really strongly on mechanical issue as it is.
You can pick up some of the features of the quantum phase transition, the particular ones associated with the different statics and polarities, that I'm not sure that there might be some different criteria for all of them.
But we can only be, what is the ratio of the energy scale to the temperature?
The strength of the quantum fluctuation.
Yeah, but that's the only, in some sense, you can see it if I had a, you know, 10,000 Kelvin, 100,000 Kelvin exchange constant, you know, room temperature, certainly good enough. On mechanical enough, but I'm just wondering in this case now.
So the energy scale here is actually much, much diluted, right? Because your Cobol set is so far apart that effectively your J is no longer, you know, your original J, it's no longer 100 degrees smaller. So maybe another way to sort of to look at this quantum mechanicness is
it's one of the most polarizable paramagnets. And so that's why this has this interesting behavior. Most of the samples, when you dilute it this much, you won't have a ferromagnet, but it's this picture where the palladium is polarized by the adjacent cobalt. And so that's why, you know, the cobalt looks much more extended than where it is. And so even with this dilution, you can have this ferromagnet.
So it's not our KPY interaction from those cobalts? It's something else?
It's not direct. You need the palladium, the mediating palladium.
Palladium is like helium 3. I think palladium was considered to be helium 3, so they could do the measure somewhere.
So the interaction is start KPY, or is some weird?
Well,
it's
a
strong view. I mean, palladium is strongly correlated with that. I mean, it's one of the biggest
it's the metal?
It's probably got the biggest.
It's a metal, but that's a star and that's a very enhanced.
Hugely enhanced. So it has strong, that itself a strong thermodynamic situation.
But I guess quantum, it's basically going to come down to the size of the domains. I mean, if you have your domain size really tiny, so there's reduced spins, then the action associated with splitting this domain is going to be even be reasonably small. If it's 10 to 23, well, a million spins, then the action is a million, and you put it into exponents, and it never fluctuates. I think that's that might be another way to look at the, I mean, how close or far away the system is from quantum phase transition. Because to have quantum phase transition, you have to have quantum fluctuations. And
mm-hmm.
you have to
but there's very clearly there, even pure palladium has very strong quantum fluctuations into thermodynamic phase. Pure palladium is strongly fluctuating. Then you put stuff into it, then all that. I'm not advocating that, but it seems you are necessarily quantum fluctuations, but it is interesting.
To find out whether there are or not.
There are questions about quantum effects, so you could compare it. And if you get this experiment on, if you have an insulating thermal magnet, you could quantum fluctuations, so you see similar types of effects, especially the short wavelength, I would assert that the short wavelength fluctuations are seen in the main wall pattern actually do measure essentially sort of pinning potentials and things like that, but one could ask how different that would be in the case where you're much closer to classical calculation problem without strong quantum fluctuations, but the only fluctuations came from the random geometry rather than from some quantum.
Well, I guess you will get better if you move closer to this point, you know, when you suppress the TC and further.
Where are you on that
curve? I'm around here. This is degrees Celsius. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not degrees Celsius. It's this is, yeah, I think this must be Kelvin.
So is the, so you have an enhanced TC over what's shown there. This is for the bulk material?
This is for the bulk material.
So is it the fact that you've got an easy axis that gives you?
No, I don't think so. The interesting thing is that each time that we grew the sample, so we grew them using sputtering, there was a difference in the transition temperature, slightly. So
the transition temperature is 316, it shows on this diagram about 50.
No, okay, let me see the temperature here. This may be Celsius. If I look here, yeah, this is Celsius. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Still actually not terribly far. I mean, relative to the underlying spin wave energies in a lot are in the mid infrared, quarter of a volt. So cobalt itself is, I mean, this is the current thesis. I mean, the cobalt itself has a large, actually fairly large suppression of its curie temperature relative to its underlying. So you have to denominate, and it's the same way like in the high TC, I'll tell you, pure lamp and pure brain has a TC of 300 Kelvin, and then it goes down to zero. But the 300 Kelvin isn't the underlying exchange constant, the line exchange constant of 10 volt. Here, it's more like it's at the same order. And so that the 11, the 1200, the zone boundary.
Can you actually compare samples which stay higher than many phantom those temperatures?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, yeah, right, pure palladium. And I don't remember exactly the number until what composition they see ferromagnetism, but it's almost like a single digit, like 1 or 2%. Even then they see ferromagnetism. So that's the thing that they find amazing. Why, you know, with this small concentration of cobalt, you can still see ferromagnetism.
In the case of Copernicus effects, we need a parallel. Of course, if you're creating some interesting results, so you would have a little cobalt in it, and then still having a parallel magnetic equal zero, then there are the strongest groups in the single. That's why I'm asking whether this is possible or whether any amount of cobalt already drives
a ferromagnetism. No. I think if you go sub 1%, that you would have. I think that people talked about thin glass in that very small doped region of cobalt. So it's not all the way ferromagnetic. So there's some cutoff, but it's extremely low. I forgot whether it was 1% or. Or maybe sub 1%.
What's the spin of cobalt?
Huh?
What is the spin of some 3 halves, 5 halves?
The spin of cobalt here. How many electrons do I have in the valence band?
So
presumably pure cobalt is reduced somewhat.
So presumably, if you dope it with something which has spin 1/2, then you have more chance to get something cooling, right? Because
mm-hmm.
then you would have to work in single digits for that. Actually, you need higher concentration of the dope concern to become ferromagnetic.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like, you know, when you dope with things, it's not every metal that works to create this kind of phase. In most of the cases, when you dilute, you just lose it. And so it's a very specific combination that allows that. So it's palladium with cobalt. I think also iron does it. But you cannot just keep substituting this with other spins. It's
this one is still strong. I mean, you can have single digits and still have power magnets. So if you put something that's weaker, maybe it's still okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have perhaps transition temperature. 400 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
All those interesting physics maybe.
Mm-hmm. There's an opportunity that because the underlying energy scales are so large, this is just like what I can see. It is possible that in some of these materials you have interesting quantum effects even at room temperature. Of course, but
don't have to go on a, like in a heavy fermion system, so if they only count them before, it's exciting. We can see what the effects of the hundreds are going to draw.
Yeah, sure, but as a matter of principle, I mean, if this one is three halves, right, and if you substitute one half, I mean, it bounds to be more than one. I mean, if you want to one.
Metals.
Okay, so I'll go to the manganite. So since there's a huge audience that is familiar with that, I'll skip all of this. And one thing that is being paid a lot of attention recently is the phase separation, which it's considered to be crucial to explain the closer magnetic resistance. So basically, people are imagining, you know, mixed a coexistence of insulating regions and metallic regions, and then as you apply a magnetic field, you align the metallic regions, and then you create a percolating path, and that's the origin of the closer magnetic resistance. So this phase separation is considered crucial for explaining the effect. And as Gabe pointed out yesterday, there have been studies on these two systems, the lanthanum strontium manganite and the lanthanum calcium manganite, both films, and when they look at the spectroscopy, so IV characteristics, they see a very inhomogeneous electronic phase, and you know they attribute that, you know, to the observation phase separation. And our question is whether this observation is intrinsic or extrinsic. And so for that, we looked at lanthanum strontium manganite at compositions around the peak of the ferromagnetic transition temperature. And so the compositions that we studied were 0.23 and 0.3, and they were grown by pulse laser deposition, and they were 1,000 angstroms thick. And they were grown on strontium titanate bicrystal substrates, where you have 45 degree artificial grain boundaries. And the reason why we did this is because we were interested in this magnetic resistive devices that are based on artificial grain boundaries. So we wanted to understand the domain structures. So that was the initial motivation, and through that we discovered something quite unusual. So this is the N versus T curves for the two different compositions, and you know, depending on the composition, you have different transition temperature, which is normal. And you have the hysteresis loops that are extremely narrow. This has unusually small coercive field, and they are in-plane magnetized. Now, in this material, of course, it's not too large. Yeah. Yeah. But the main thing that we were interested in is looking at the reason why we picked up this system is because it has the transition above room temperature. So it's easier to image. And we wanted to understand, you know, how the magnetization vanishes near the transition temperature using a local probe. So that's why we picked up this sample. The other reason we picked up the sample is because, you know, the other systems have more complicated phase diagrams, so we didn't want to get, you know, complications by introducing other phases. And so that's why the lanthanum strontium manganite was chosen. So this, as I said, has magnetic anisotropy, where the in-plane axis is the easy axis. So you see the magnetization jumping to full magnetization very quickly at small magnetic fields when you apply the field in the plane, whereas when you apply it out of the plane, it requires a huge field to tilt the moments out of the plane. And the X-ray characterization on this sample shows that the C-axis is compressed compared to the freeform. So the freeform, the C-axis should be 3.8 angstroms, whereas if we grow it on STO, we get a smaller lattice constant in the C-direction. And that is to lattice match the in-plane lattice constants of the strontium. So you get a compression in the C-axis. And that in which direction the compression occurs, whether it's in the plane or it's in the out of the plane direction, people have observed different magnetic anisotropy. Now, this is the AFM image of the sample. Okay, so this shows the topography, and these leaves that you see are basically the atomic terraces of the LSMO, and they're very smooth. So this is what people call the step flow growth, which is characteristic of good samples. If you remember the sample that Gabe showed from other people, where they looked at the topography, it's extremely rough. Whereas in this case, this is just atomic steps. So it's a very high quality sample. And this is very important when you look at the properties of this film, the quality of the film. That can really change the behavior, the electronic and magnetic behavior. Now, this is the MFM image that corresponds to this part, which is the topography. So here's the grain boundary, and we see the magnetic domain wall right at the grain boundary. And we see other domain walls as well. And you see that the orientation of the domain walls have rotated as we cross this artificial grain boundary. And the reason is because the crystal, underlying crystal substrate is 45 degrees rotated as you cross this grain boundary. And so if the magnetic EZ axis is strongly coupled to the underlying crystal, then you would have a rotation naturally. And that's what we're seeing. So this shows the quality of the film that is really high quality, that you can see this well-defined domain walls that follow some crystallographic orientation as you move, and the crystal has oriented, everything has rotated as well. There's another interesting thing, which is this texture within the domains. And this is something that in the past was attributed as this being the domains. When people saw these things, these textures, people attributed them to the magnetic domain walls. Whereas after we saw this big, much stronger features, we recognize this is just small fluctuations within a domain.
Are they static?
They're static.
Are they fluctuations of the moment size or the moment direction?
We think it's the moment direction.
So that means that along your artificial domain wall, your moments are canted up out of the plane or something like that?
Yes, it could be. It could be canted out of the plane.
Maybe just source morphology
that is causing that. We don't think it's just surface morphology, because this is not surface morphology. Here it's not. This certainly has a surface morphology, but not this region. It has no surface morphology. Right. So there's no surface morphology there. Now, we see this texture, as I said, within a domain, and the direction perpendicular to that texture is the EZ axis, which is well known in, if you look at any magnetic domain book, they will tell you that people can observe these textures, and then the EZ axis is perpendicular to that. Now, we were wondering why we have this fluctuation in the EZ axis. Why isn't it just clean and with no contrast? And we think that it has to do with the underlying the crystal structure of the film itself that has that texture. Because when we did the X-ray diffraction of that film, and we looked at the out-of-plane components and also the in-plane components, so by fixing L at this value means that I'm looking at the film, because L equals 1 corresponds to the substrate. Besides this main peak, we see this super lattice, the superstructure in the peak. So there's something with a periodicity of, this is 0.05, so 20 times the lattice constant in the crystal structure of the film. So we think that is what is causing this fluctuation in the magnetization, small angle fluctuation. So there's direct coupling between the crystal structure and the magnetic structure. So from this orientation of the texture, we can tell what is the easy axis. So this is the easy axis, and then this is the easy axis. You see that the not only the domain walls have rotated, but also the texture itself has rotated as we go to the next crystal. So it shows how consistent everything is. It's very self-consistent. And so the easy axis has rotated by 45 degrees here. And we did crystallography, and then we know that this is the 100 direction. So the easy axis is in the 100, not in the 110. The other thing that we found was, besides that artificial grain boundary, there was a tiny, you know, defect. So some kind of, some line defect here. It's very hard to see here, but if you look at the direct image, you see a very faint line here in the topography, and right there was a formation of a domain wall. Now, by looking at this structure, we can tell that the easy axis points in this direction, so in the horizontal direction. And so the only kind of wall that you can have here is a 180-degree wall. So we determined that these are 180-degree walls. On the other hand, if you look at this wall that is associated with this line defect, it is different from this wall, because this wall is symmetric, has a mirror symmetry. It's a mirror symmetry. Whereas this one, it doesn't have the mirror symmetry. So the right side is different from the left side is different from the right. And so we believe that these are 360-degree domain walls. So that the magnetization, I cannot tell whether it's pointing to the right or to the left, but a possible magnetic configuration is that this is pointing to the right, and this is also pointing to the right, and this is pointing to the left, and this is pointing to the left. So right has switched to left. Right has switched to left here. So this is a 180-degree wall, whereas this is a 360-degree wall due to a line defect. The 180-degree wall cannot give me an asymmetric pattern. It should be symmetric. Can give me. You can imagine the things rotating out of the plane and then flipping.
Why would it show up? I think I'm not going to ask why it would show up in an asymmetric fashion in this image. Around it. But what? You're sensitive to the component out of the plane, for example, around it.
Right, but how it is rotating, right? So if it's going like this or it's going like this.
If you either see the negative contrast and positive contrast.
So do you ever see negative contrast grain boundaries that you ascribe to the 180?
Oh, so where the field lines are going into the film? Yes, in principle, yes. Yes. Well, in this film, I only see this contrast. In this film, okay. But if I look at a magnetic bit, yes, I do see going up or the field lines emerging up, out, or going in at a domain wall. But the fact that this has this asymmetry means that it cannot be 180. And the very interesting thing is that as I cross this 180 wall has changed. The chirality has changed. So it's all very self-consistent. That's the important thing. You know, from these images, it's always much harder to say what is the absolute thing, you know, whether this is pointing to the right or to the left. But I can make all kinds of arguments based on, you know, symmetry or, you know, whether the image makes sense. And then it does. So So this must be 180 domain walls, and this must be 360 domain walls. So a defect line is creating a 360 domain wall.
So why do they actually exist at all in those 360?
So based on what you have, you know, there's a what's called topological defect or something, and then.
So you mean there's some screw dislocation or something which bends this? Because 360 doesn't make any sense.
Right, from the magnetostatic point of view, it doesn't make sense, but you're creating a domain wall that costs you energy, right? But on the other hand, if the defect has some kind of crystal structure that prefers the spin to point perpendicular to that defect, then there's an incentive for the spins to be not in the plane but out of the plane. And so you can imagine creating a domain wall.
But then it doesn't need to be screwed. It could be sort of, for example, an insulation like this, then goes up and then goes down again. So it could be a 0 degree kind of defect.
So it goes up, down, and up, and down.
But
so you're saying going like this, the spin going like this, and then up, up,
and then just goes
like that?
Same kind of more full and simple three.
What I'm thinking is more like this. Making a full turn. Yeah, that would look symmetric also. But his question is the physics. Why does he want to create this kind of
because if it has some kind of chirality, I mean, if the defect, structural defect, has some kind of chirality, then I would imagine that there is no, do you expect, for example, if you have the defined chirality, some kind of dislocation in your system, do you expect that minimization? I mean, it could do this below, right? But then you're saying that on the top it will do the opposite.
The opposite, yeah. The other thing that you can think about is, you know, how slowly the spins want to change, you know, when it's going through a domain wall. So you can think about a gradual change because you think about the exchange coupling constant between the spins in the domain wall. So it wants to do a gradual change. So you can imagine the 360 wall is slowly changing and then winding around 360.
Yeah, I could say that, you know, here you have to rotate 360 and here you have to do just 90 back and forth, so it's 180. So it's a fewer angle to have to line.
So maybe this is a question for you to calculate, you know, what is the incentive of, you know, creating such a 360 domain wall?
There is no simple reason, you're saying.
I don't think there's a simple reason. And we believe that this 180 degree domain walls are cross tie wall. I'm actually going to skip this. So we wanted to know how the phase transition in this LSMO happens. So we warmed up one of the samples, the 0.3 composition. So this is the 300 Kelvin image. And so here you see this is the domain wall. And as I warm up the sample, and I reach the Curie temperature determined by the squid, which is 350, I just see, you know, clouds. It's very hard to determine what it is happening here. But the drastic thing that happened was when I went above the Curie temperature, there was a huge contrast between the regions around the artificial grain boundary and away from the grain boundary. I was expecting a paramagnetic film that was homogeneous. Instead, I found a strong contrast that can only happen if there's a ferromagnet. And so, you know, from this contrast itself, it's hard to tell which is the ferromagnetic region, which is the paramagnetic region, but from the fact that most of the sample is paramagnetic, you know, determined by the magnetometer, means that the smaller area region is the ferromagnet. So you see ferromagnetism persisting around the defect. And then that ferromagnetism around the defects shrinks as a function of temperature, probably because the Curie temperature in the regions more closer to the center of the defect have higher Curie temperature than away, and so then they start becoming paramagnet earlier. So the regions around the grain boundary are the ones that remain ferromagnet to higher temperature. And then it's about 370 Kelvin when that disappears. So this is the collection of the images. Now, we took larger scale images, And this is an MFM data at 350 Kelvin. Now at 300 Kelvin, I don't see all these features, whereas at 350 Kelvin, I start seeing these features, and above that, I see it much more clearly. So these are all the defects that exist in the sample. So all the defects have a higher ferromagnetic transition temperature. And the orientation of the defects are in agreement with what people know in the literature. So this is the 0.3 doping, the 0.3 doping sample. And here, the 100 axis is actually the one that goes 45 degrees. And in this case, is the one that goes orthogonal to the edges. And the defects are known to run in the 110 direction. So it's completely in agreement with what people know about the defects in the samples. And you see that the defects have rotated as you cross the grain boundary. So everything is consistent, which is surprising.
How high up can you go and still keep ferromagnetism being, for example, in this grain
boundary? 370. Whereas the rest of the film went paramagnetic 350. So there's 20 Kelvin difference in the Curie temperature on the film. So this is the Curie temperature plot as a function of distance from the artificial grain boundary. It's the highest around the artificial grain boundary and then drops by 20 Kelvin as I go away. And that distance over which the change happens is 1 micron, which is mesoscopic. So before, when I talked about the compositional disorder-induced magnetic fluctuations, it was on the atomic scale. In this case, it's on the mesoscopic scale. So the origin must be different. Now, since everybody's always skeptical about scanning probes, we did the magnetic hysteresis measurements in this same film. And then if you look at 360 Kelvin, it looks like the hysteresis is gone. So I see some hysteresis here, but it's gone at 360 Kelvin. So you wonder why, because there's still ferromagnetism in the MFM. But if you look at the data more closely, there is still hysteresis. It's that they're just tiny. The tiny, tiny hysteresis, because the area that is still ferromagnetic is small. And then they close completely at 370 Kelvin. So it agrees with the local probe measurement. And then since they appeared at grain boundaries, we thought that maybe the powder sample that was used to grow the film also had the same kind of grain boundary magnetism. So we searched for hysteresis loops on this powder sample above the Curie temperature that we measured, 373. And we couldn't find them. So at 370 Kelvin, around that time, they're closed. So it's not the same in the powder sample as in the film. The other thing that we saw in the film was spin reorientation at grain boundaries. Not all the time, but sometimes. So this is a room temperature image. And you see a huge white blob here. We think that it's at that point where the spins are perpendicular to the film in those regions. So we see spin reorientation in the MFM. Now, so we believe that not only the Curie temperature is different in the grain boundaries, but also the magnetic anisotropy. So if you look at this figure, which I showed you before, the room temperature magnetization data, so has the in-plane magnetic anisotropy that is very clear. Now, if you look at the measurements done above the transition temperature of the majority of the film, you see that there's no longer a magnetic anisotropy. The thing is that at that point, the only regions that remain ferromagnetic are around the defect. So those defect regions have no preferential magnetic orientation. So it's isotropic. And so we believe that it's also the same below the transition temperature is simply that there, most of the volume, most of the moment measured come from the in-plane. From regions away from the grain boundary which have implemented position. So that's why you cannot pick it up, because it's just the sum of all the moments that you're measuring. But when you exclude those that have the in-plane magnetization, then, which is above the, you know, Q temperature of the majority of the film, you see that there's no magnetic anisotropy. So we believe that these grain boundary regions don't have the in-plane anisotropy as the rest. So it's not only the Q temperature is different, but also the anisotropy is different. So this is what we saw, basically, that there is distinct magnetic regions around the grain boundary at temperature above the bulk of the Q temperature of the film. And they're about 2 microns length scale, and they have a Q temperature about 20 Kelvin above the rest of the film, and there's no magnetic anisotropy in those regions. But we don't find them in the bulk powder sample. So grain boundary is not enough to explain for the effect. So it's something special about the film. So I said at the beginning of my talk, you know, it was about magnetic and electronic inhomogeneity in films. So what's the thing that is special about film? We think that is the effect of strain on this magnetic properties. So when we plot together, after finding those differences, we plot together the powder sample that was used to grow the film and the film itself, you see that there's a difference of 20 Kelvin in the transition temperature. So we think that it's the strain on the film that causes the suppression of the TC. And then we think that near the grain boundaries, the strain is relaxed, and that's why the TC is higher. Yeah, I'm wrapping up. So to confirm that, we did X-ray microdiffraction. And let me skip this. So this is the X-ray beam on our sample. So we scanned the beam over the sample. So we started on one side of the grain boundary, and then we moved it towards the grain boundary, and then we moved it away from the grain boundary. So we did a spatial spatial-dependent crystallography on this sample. So this is the diffraction peak coming from one side of the film. It's 0.002 diffraction peak. So it's looking at the C lattice constant. And then this is when the beam is sitting on the middle of the grain boundary. So we get both diffractions. But you see that the diffraction spot has moved down, which means the C lattice constant has gone up at the grain boundary. So it's a different lattice constant, different crystal structure. And then this is looking at the other side of the grain. So away from the grain boundary, we covered back to the value that you saw before here. So basically, there's an evolution of the crystal structure, and which is plotted here. And then you see that change of the crystal structure is about, you know, 1 micron length scale, which is comparable to the change of the Q temperature measured by the local probe. And the substrate itself doesn't have that effect. So the substrate's lattice constant stays invariant. So it's something to do with the film. It's basically you have imposed some distortion of the lattice by the substrate on the film, but then at the grain boundary it chooses to relax. So if you combine both data, the MFM data and the X-ray diffraction data, you see that there's not much change in the lattice constant required to cause such an effect of 20 Kelvin. So this is like 0.15 Angstrom's change, 0.015. So to come back to this point, you know, whether this is intrinsic or extrinsic, and these are films, we think from our observation there's an extrinsic effect. So basically that there's a change in the properties of the film. So these electronic properties, the variation of the electronic properties are not necessarily intrinsic, but it may be due to some strain induced in homogeneity. Now, this is some work done by our collaborators, and we're working together to try to figure out what's the cause of the effect. So what they did is they grow an LCMO film, so it's a sample that shows charge ordering, and they did microfabrication on the film. So they used ion milling and, you know, FIB. So they isolated this part of the film. So if this is the whole film, then they cut the film in these regions, and then they also milled away a large part of the substrate behind, you know, under this film. And then when they looked at the charge order superstructure, they found different ordering wave vectors in this region versus in this region. So this is the different ordering wave vector for the two parts of the film. So this is the part in this region, and the red data is in this region. So there's about 3% change in the charge ordering wave vector. But this was done with electron diffraction. But when they look at the lattice constant with their limited resolution, they don't see, and their resolution can only measure lattice constant difference of 1%, they don't see, they are not able to detect us. So we're trying to do X-ray microdiffraction of these regions versus these regions to try to find out what's the underlying cause of the difference in the charge ordering wave vector. And you see that this is, you know, microscopic length scale, which was, you know, fabricated artificially. So to conclude, basically, you see this inhomogeneity in the magnetic properties in films. So like the, in the palladium cobalt, which is compositional, due to compositional disorder, and it's an atomic scale. In the case of the manganate film, it's due to strain, it's a mesoscopic scale, and then now we're seeing in LCMO, which is in a microscopic scale. Thank you.
Very quickly.
So your question in all these experimental results that have reported micrometer scale structures in manganese, I suppose. But then we have the mountain of results telling us that at the nanoscale something is happening as well. Right? We have neutron scattering results for lanthanum calcium manganese oxide showing that below a temperature of 400 Kelvin, there are little bubbles that are called, according to Chef Lin, they are called CE bubbles. Now they have the same structure as a CE phase. So that appears to still be there and be correlated with the CMR effect. And the intensity of those features follows, if you put that together with the resistivity against temperature, that they go one over the other almost. So I would frame what you have found as a critique to the micrometer scale, very large scale of reported, for example, by the group in by Feth et al. But all the rest seems to remain.
Oh, I'm not criticizing everything. So what I'm saying is that, for example, even in our bismuth calcium manganite, we saw two different regions, even at room temperature, that there was some local charge ordering, right? Showed the domain wall at room temperature, the charge ordering part and the charge disorder part. So that can occur naturally. But what I'm saying is that when people look at the films and when they see so much inhomogeneity in the film, they have to be cautious in pointing out that that is intrinsic. So there may be an extrinsic factor, because basically these films, you know, as you know, nobody has obtained atomic scale images of manganese in films, okay, let alone it's hard enough in the bulk. So the films are just always susceptible to these issues with the growth and then the strain that is imposed on them. And so it tends to be more irregular. And then I was reading your physics reports, you know, where you pointed out that in the case of the films, you know, this can cause this inhomogeneity. And I personally believe that that's a big reason why the CMR effect was discovered by Jin in the film. You know, the same LC-MO system was nothing new, but why suddenly in 1995 there was such a huge, huge effect observed? It's because it was grown in a film. I think that the fact that these films can induce this inhomogeneities play a big role in the large MR effect. And as you pointed out also, which is something that I was always thinking, if you look at the final resistivity, it's about the same as the bulk. But what gives the large magnitude resistance is the initial zero field resistivity that is large. And why is rough? Because it's crummy. So you started with something crummy and you started, and then you begin to homogenize it with the magnetic field, and that's why finally you get the same that you see in the bulk.
Thank you.